October 8th, 25 missing letters in front of the words, "He keeps threatening me." This was followed by 21 more missing letters. October 9th had 19 missing letters and continued with, "He forced me. I want to kill myself. I want to kill him." October 17th had no words, just 33 coded letters. And the last entry, written on October 29th, began with 18 missing letters and ended with a defiant statement, "Mrs. Tate said so. She said that the age difference means he'll go to prison for sure. It stops today. I am so happy." "October 29th is the day she was killed," Lila said. "How do we know she's talking about Carl?" "There are dozens of pages where she talks about Carl being the pervert that watched her from his window," Lila said. "He snuck up on her when she was having sex with Andy. It's not a coincidence that the threats began right after that." The code could change everything. "There are other entries that aren't coded," she said. "Look at this one from September 22nd, the day after the terrible day when she got caught with Andy Fisher. September 22nd. "If they find out, it'll destroy me. They will send me to Catholic school. Goodbye cheerleading. Goodbye life."
"Don't you think that seems a bit dramatic?" I said. "I mean, they have cheerleaders at Catholic schools too, don't they?"
Lila shot a skeptical glance at me. "You obviously don't understand the brain of an adolescent girl. Everything is the end of the world. They're emotional to the point of being suicidal."
She paused, as if distracted by a thought. Then she continued,
"Some things can truly seem like the end of the world."
"Who is Mrs. Tate?" I asked, looking at the last entry.
"You didn't read the transcripts, did you?"
Lila said, sounding exasperated. "I sort of read them," I said, "but I don't remember Mrs. Tate."
"She was a school guidance counselor."
Lila pulled one of the transcripts from the box and started flipping through it until she got to Mrs. Tate's testimony.
"Here it is."
She handed the transcript to me, and I read. "And when you met with Crystal Hagen that day, what were her concerns? What did she talk about?"
"She was real vague. She wanted to know if oral sex was sex. I mean, she wanted to know if someone forced you to have oral sex, could that be called rape?"
"Did she tell you why she wanted to know?"
"No, she wouldn't say. She kept saying that she was asking for a friend. That happens a lot in my business. I tried to get her to tell more. I asked her if someone was forcing her to have oral sex. She didn't answer. And she asked me if it's force, if the person was making you do it by threatening to tell a secret about you."
"And what did you tell her?"
"I said that it could be considered coercion." "Then she asked me, what if the guy is older?"
"And you responded how?"
"As a school counselor, we receive training on the law regarding stuff like this. I told her that given her age, if a man is more than 2 years older than her, it doesn't matter if there is coercion or not. Consent is not an issue. If an older man is having sex with a 14-year-old, it's rape. I told her that if something like that was happening, she needed to tell me, or tell the police, or her parents. I told her if something like that was happening, the man will go to prison for it."
"And what was her response to that?"
"She just smiled a really big smile. Then she thanked me and left my office."
"And you're sure that conversation took place on October 29th of last year?"
"That conversation took place the day that Crystal was killed. I'm sure of that."
I closed the transcript. "So Crystal went home, wrote an entry in her diary, and then went to Carl's house to confront him?"
"Either that, or she took the diary with her to school," Lila said.
"It makes sense, doesn't it?"
"Crystal knew that she had the upper hand. It would be his life that got ruined, not hers."
"So the same day she's planning to put an end to it, Carl's out buying a gun?"
"Maybe he was planning on putting an end to it, too," Lila said. "Maybe his plan all along was to kill her that day."
I stared down at the coded pages, their secret knowledge taunting me.
"I wish we could break that code," I said. "I can't believe his lawyer didn't work harder to break it."
"He did," she said. Lila pulled a piece of paper out of the file and handed it to me. It was a copy of a letter to the Department of Defense. The date on the letter showed that it was written 2 months before the trial. It had been signed by Carl's attorney, John Peterson. In the letter, Peterson was asking the Department of Defense to help decipher the diary code.
"Did the Department of Defense ever respond?" I asked. "Not that I could find," she said.
There's no other mention of the code being deciphered at all.
You would think that they would move heaven and earth to decipher the code before they went to trial.
Unless...
Lila looked at me and shrugged. Unless what?
Unless Carl already knew what it would say. Maybe he didn't want the code deciphered, because he knew it would be the final nail in his coffin.
Chapter 18. I called Janet the next day and made an appointment for that evening to see Carl. I wanted to ask him about the diary and the code. I wanted to know why such an important part of the prosecutor's case went unchallenged. I wanted to see his face when he told me whether or not he knew what Crystal Hagen meant when she wrote in her diary that it stops today. I wanted to test his honesty, but first I needed to talk to Berthel Collins. It took me several tries, leaving messages each time, and when he finally called me back, I was already on the road driving to Hillview Manor. "What can I do for you, Joe?" he asked. "Thanks for calling me back, Mr. Collins," I said. "I came across something odd in the trial file that I wanted to ask you about." "That was a long time ago, but I'll do my best to give you an answer," he said. "There was this diary, Crystal Hagen's diary. It had a code. Do you remember that?" Collins paused on the other side of the line and then, in a low, somber tone, said, "Yeah, I remember it." "Well, I found a letter to the Department of Defense where Mr. Peterson tried to get it deciphered. What happened with that?" Another pause, then Collins answered, "Peterson signed that letter, but I wrote it. That was one of my contributions to the case. We didn't have personal computers back in 1980, at least nothing like we have today. We figured that the Department of Defense would have the technology to break the code, so Peterson assigned me the task of contacting the DOD. I spent hours trying to find someone to take my call. After a couple weeks of trying, I found this guy who said he would see what he could do."
"So what happened? Did you ever get an answer?"
"No. Things were moving at the speed of light on our end, but dealing with the DOD was like swimming in jelly. I don't know if you saw this in the file, but Iverson demanded a speedy trial."
"A speedy trial? What's that mean?"
"A defendant can request that his case be brought to trial within 60 days. We rarely do that because the longer a case lingers, the better it gets for the defense. We get more discovery. We have time to do a thorough investigation of our own. Witnesses become less reliable. There was no reason for Iverson to demand a speedy trial, but he did. I was there when Peterson tried to convince him to back off the demand. We needed time to prepare. We needed to hear back from the DOD. Iverson didn't care. Remember how I said he didn't help with his case, like he was watching it on television? That's what I'm talking about."
"So what happened with the Department of Defense? Why didn't they break the code?"
"We weren't a priority to them. This was before you were born, but that year, 1980, the Iranians were holding 52 Americans hostage. That was also an election year. Everyone was focused on the crisis, and I couldn't get anyone to talk to me or call me back. The packet I sent them disappeared into some black hole. After the trial, I called them to tell them that it was too late, that they didn't need to work on our code anymore. They had no idea what code I was talking about."
"Did the prosecutor ever try to break the code?"
"I don't think so. I mean, why would he? The inferences all pointed toward Iverson. He didn't need the code to be deciphered. He knew that the jury would read into it what he told them to read into it."
I pulled into the parking lot of Hillview and parked my car, laying my head against the headrest. I had one last question, but I hesitated to ask it. A part of me wanted to believe that he was not the monster that the prosecutor talked about, but I wanted the truth. "Mr. Collins, a friend of mine thinks that Carl didn't want the diary to be deciphered. She thinks that he knew that it would have pointed at him. Is that true?"
"Your friend is perceptive," he said thoughtfully. "We had that same discussion 30 years ago. I think John Peterson agreed with your friend. I got the feeling that John didn't really want the code solved. That's why he gave it to me to do. I was a lowly clerk at the time. I think John wanted to document that we tried, but he didn't really want to receive the results because, well..."
Collins took in a deep breath and sighed.
"The truth is, it can be hard sometimes to give it all you got defending a man that you know murdered his victim."
"Did you ever ask Carl about the diary code?"
"Certainly. Like I said, John tried to convince Carl to back off the speedy trial demand. That was one of our arguments, that we might get some good evidence from deciphering the code."
"What did Carl say?"
"It's hard to explain.
Most guys who are guilty will take a plea bargain. He refused a second degree. And most guys who are innocent will delay trial for as long as it takes to get their case prepared. He demanded a speedy trial. We were trying to decipher the code, and it seemed like he was working against us. I gotta tell you, Joe, it seemed to me like Carl Iverson wanted to go to prison. Chapter 19. I walked over to Carl and sat down in the lounge chair beside him, his slight sideways glance being the only acknowledgement of my arrival. Then, after a moment, he said,
"Beautiful day."
"It is," I replied. I hesitated before launching into our interview. I wasn't going to pick up where we left off, talking about the day he got his draft notice. Instead, I wanted to talk about why he wanted the speedy trial and why he seemed to not want the diary deciphered. I suspected that my choice of topic would spoil the rest of Carl's day, so I tried to ease into the conversation. "I talked to Berthel Collins today," I said.
"Who?"
"Berthel Collins. He was one of your attorneys."
"My attorney was John Peterson," he said, "and he died years ago, or at least that's what I heard."
"Collins worked as a law clerk on your case." Carl thought for a moment, apparently trying to remember Collins. Then he said,
"I seem to remember a kid sitting in the room on some of the visits. That was so long ago. Is he a lawyer now?"
"He's the chief public defender in Minneapolis," I said.
"Well, good for him," he said. "And why did you talk to Mr. Collins?"
"I'm trying to figure out what those coded messages in Crystal Hagen's diary meant." His gaze never shifted from the apartment balcony across the way. He seemed unmoved by my bringing up the diary, treating my announcement with the insignificance of a burp.
"So," he said, "you're a detective now, are you?"
"No," I said, "but I do like a good puzzle, and this one seems to be a real challenge."
"You want an interesting puzzle?" he said. "Take a look at the pictures."
That was not where I wanted our conversation to go. "I saw the pictures," I said, as the images of Crystal Hagen's corpse flashed across my memory. They almost made me throw up. I have no interest in looking at them again.
"Oh, no, not those pictures," he said,
turning his body so that he faced me for the first time since I arrived. A sickly pallor washed over his face.
I'm so sorry you had to see those pictures."
I could tell by his face that he could still see the trial photos in his mind after all these years, his features giving way to a 30-year-old gravity.
"Those pictures were terrible. Nobody should have to look at them." "No, I'm talking about the pictures taken of the fire, before the police arrived. Have you seen those?"
"No," I said. "What about them?"
"Have you ever read a Highlights magazine when you were a kid?"
"Highlights?"
"Yeah, you'd find them in dentist offices and doctors' waiting rooms. They're magazines for kids."
"Can't say I've seen one," I said. Carl smiled and nodded.
"Well, they have these pictures in them. Two pictures that appear to be identical, but there are small differences. The game is to find the differences. Find the anomalies."
"Sure," I said. "I did those kinds of things in grade school."
"If you like solving puzzles and riddles, find the pictures that were taken before and after the fire department arrived and look at them. Play that game. See if you can spot the anomaly." "It's hard to see. It took me years to notice it, but then again, I didn't have the head start you'll have. I'll give you a hint. What you're looking at might be looking at you."
"You had the pictures in prison?"
"My attorney sent me copies of most of the stuff in the file. Had all the time in the world to read it after they convicted me."
"Why didn't you take more of an interest in your case before they convicted you?" I asked. Carl looked at me like he was eyeing an unusual chess move. Maybe he saw where I was going with my question, my not-so-subtle segue.
"What do you mean?"
"Collins said that you demanded a speedy trial." He thought for a moment and said,
"That is true."
"Why?"
"It's a long story," he said.
"Collins said they wanted more time, but you pushed to go to trial."
"Yes, I did."
"He thinks you wanted to go to prison." Carl said nothing, setting his gaze back toward the window. I pressed on. "I want to know why you didn't fight harder to stay out of prison." He hesitated before answering. Then he said, I thought it would silence the nightmare. Now we're getting somewhere, I thought.
The nightmare?
I watched as he paused his breathing and swallowed hard. Then, in a low, calm voice, a voice that came from somewhere deep in his soul, he said,
I've done things. Things that I thought I could live with. But I was wrong.
This is your dying declaration, I said, trying to jump into his thoughts, hoping to grease the skids of his catharsis. This is why you're telling me your story, to get this off your chest.
I saw the surrender in his eye, the desire to tell me his story. I wanted to scream at him to confess, but I whispered my words instead, hoping not to frighten him away.
I'll listen to you. I promise I won't judge. Came here to bring me absolution, did you?
He spoke barely above a whisper. Not absolution, I said, but telling me what happened might help. They say that confession is good for the soul.
They say that, do they?
His attention shifted slowly toward me.
And do you agree with what they say?
He asked. Sure, I said. I think that if you have something that is troubling you, telling someone about it can be a good thing.
Should we try that?
He said.
Should we test that idea?
I think we should, I said.
Then tell me about your grandfather,
he said. I felt a lump in my chest that stunned me. I looked away from him while I tried to calm my thoughts. What about my grandpa? I said. Kara leaned in, still speaking in that soft voice. He said,
That first day we met, I mentioned him just in passing. I asked how he died, and you froze. Something heavy came over you. I could see it in your eyes. Tell me what happened to him.
He died when I was 11 years old, that's all. For a long while, Carl said nothing, letting the heaviness of my hypocrisy settle onto my shoulders. Then he sighed and shrugged.
I understand, he said. I'm just a school project.
An unsettling voice began to bounce around inside my head, fed by my own guilt, a voice that whispered to me, urging me to tell Carl my secret. Why not tell him? The voice said. He would take my secret to the grave in a matter of weeks. Besides, it would be my good faith payment to him for the confession that he would give to me. But then another voice, a quieter voice, told me that good faith had nothing to do with why I needed to tell Kara my secret. I wanted to tell him. Kara looked down at his hands as he continued.
You don't have to tell me, he said. That was never our deal.
I watched my grandpa die. I blurted. The words escaped my brain and shot out of my mouth before I could stop them. Carl looked at me, startled by my interruption. Like a cliff diver, leaving the safety of his perch, that single moment of courage or recklessness started an action I could not reverse. I stared out the window now, as I had seen Carl do so many times, and I gathered the details of my memory to me. When my thoughts were clear enough, I spoke again. I've never told anybody this, I said, but it was my fault he died. Chapter 20. What I remembered most about my Grandpa Bill were his hands, powerful bulldog paws with stubby fingers as thick as lug nuts, fingers that pulsed with agility as he worked on the small engines that he repaired. I remembered him holding my hand in his when I was little, and the feeling it gave me that everything would be okay. I remembered how he moved through the world with utter patience, giving attention and purpose to every task he performed, whether it was cleaning his glasses or helping my mother through a bad day. He had been there for her in my earliest memories, his whispers drowning out her shouts, his hand on her shoulder able to tame a storm. She had always been bipolar. That's not a condition you can suddenly catch like the flu. But when my Grandpa Bill was alive, the waves never grew into white caps. He used to tell me stories about fishing the Minnesota River, up near Mankato, where he grew up, hauling in catfish and walleye by the boatload, and I would dream of the day when I might go fishing with him. Then, when I was 11 years old, that day came. My grandpa borrowed a boat from a friend of his, and we launched at the landing at Judson to float down the river with its slow yet powerful current, the plan being to end up at a park in Mankato before nightfall. That spring, the river had overflowed its banks with the snow runoff, but by July, when we went fishing, it had settled down. The flood had left behind a scattering of dead cottonwood trees jutting up from the river bottom, their branches breaking the water's surface like skeletal fingers. Grandpa Bill kept the motor of the little fishing boat idling, so we could maneuver around the trees when we needed to. Occasionally, I would hear the screech of wood on aluminum as a branch hiding just below the surface scraped against the hull. The sound frightened me at first, but Grandpa Bill acted like it was as natural as the breeze rustling the leaves around us. That made me feel safe. I caught my first fish within the first hour, and I lit up like it was Christmas. I'd never caught a fish before, and the feel of catching that fish, the twitching of my rod, seeing him lift out of the water flipping and flopping, thrilled me. I was a fisherman. The day meandered beneath a clear blue sky with him catching a few fish and me catching a few more. I think he fished without bait some of the time just to let me get ahead. By noon we had a decent stringer of fish. He told me to drop the anchor so that we could keep our lines in the water as we ate our lunch. The anchor, which was attached to the boat at the bow, where I sat, dragged along the bottom of the river for a ways until it finally caught and brought our boat to a halt in the middle of the river. We washed our hands with water from a canteen, and Grandpa Bill pulled ham and cheese sandwiches out of a plastic grocery bag. We ate the best sandwiches I'd ever tasted, washing them down with bottles of cold root beer. It was a glorious lunch, eaten in the middle of a river at the apex of a perfect day. When my grandpa finished his food, he folded his sandwich bag into a small wad and carefully placed it in the grocery bag, which had now become our trash bag. Then, when he finished his root beer, he put his empty bottle in the bag, using the same deliberate motion. He handed the bag to me so that I could follow his lead. "Always keep the boat clean," he said. "Don't leave trash lying around or the tackle box open. That's how accidents happen." I listened with one ear as I sipped my root beer. Once I drained the last of my drink, Grandpa Bill told me to pull up the anchor. Another thing I had never done before. He had turned his attention to the motor, pumping a little ball in the gas line to get it ready to start. He wasn't watching as I laid my empty bottle on the floor of the boat. I would throw it away later, I told myself. I gripped the nylon rope that tethered us to the anchor and pulled. The anchor did not budge. I pulled harder and felt the boat edge upstream, the anchor still not moving. The boat had a flat stem plate for a bow, so I braced my feet against the stem and pulled hand over hand, pulling the boat slowly toward the anchor until my progress ground to a halt. Grandpa Bill saw my struggles and coached me to pull left and right to work the anchor loose, but the thing would not come up. Then, behind me, I heard Grandpa Bill stir in his seat. I felt the boat rock. When I looked over my shoulder, I saw him making his way forward to help me. As he stepped over a bench seat that separated us, he put his foot down on my empty bottle. His ankle twisted, curling his foot sideways. He tilted and fell backward, his thigh crashing against the side of the boat, his arms swinging at the air, his torso wrenching around to face the river as he hit. The splash drenched me as the river swallowed my grandpa. I screamed his name as he disappeared into the murky water. I screamed twice more before he popped to the surface, grabbing for the boat, his hand missing the edge by the width of a penny. His second attempt wasn't even close. The current had him, and it pulled him away from me as I sat there holding onto that stupid anchor rope, never realizing that if I had let go of the rope, the boat would have floated downstream alongside my grandpa, at least for 20 feet or so. By the time he righted himself, he had moved well beyond the reach of the boat, even if I had released the anchor rope. I yelled and prayed and begged for him to swim. It all happened so fast. Then everything soared to a whole new level of bad. Grandpa Bill began to thrash around in the water, his arms flailing, clutching at the surface of the river, his leg pinned in place by something hidden in the wet darkness. Later, the sheriff would tell my mother that his boot caught on the branch of a dead cottonwood tree just beneath the surface of the river. I watched him struggle to keep his face above the water as the current pushed him under. He didn't have his life jacket zipped shut. It pulled at his arms, tangling them above his head, his upper body tugging against the trap boot. It was only then that it dawned on me to release my rope. I let it go and paddled with my hand until the rope snapped tight about 30 feet upstream of my grandfather. I could see him scratching and tearing to pull free of the life jacket. I couldn't move. I couldn't think. I just stood there and watched and yelled until my grandfather stopped moving and floated limp in the current. I told Carl my story, choking back my tears, pausing repeatedly to let my chest settle. It wasn't until I finished that I noticed that Carl had laid his hand on my arm in an attempt to comfort me. To my surprise, I didn't pull away from him.
"You know it wasn't your fault," he said.
"I don't know that at all," I said. "That's the big lie I've been trying to tell myself for the past 10 years. I could have put the bottle in the trash bag. I could have let go of that rope when he fell in. I had a knife in the tackle box. I could have cut the boat loose and saved him. Believe me, I've gone over it 1,000,000 times. I could have done 100 things differently, but I didn't do anything."
"You were just a kid," Carl said.
"I could have saved him," I said. I had the choice to try or to watch. I chose wrong. That's all there is to that.
"But I don't want to talk about it anymore," I snapped.
Janet tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned with a jerk.
"I'm sorry, Joe," she said, "but visiting hours are over."
I looked at the clock on the wall and saw that it was 8:10. I had been talking for the entire visit, and I felt drained. My mind spun as the memory of that terrible day swirled and bounced, unfettered in my head, cut loose from its moorings by Carl Iverson. I felt cheated, because we had never gotten around to talking about Carl. And at the same time, I felt a sense of relief for having told my secret to someone. I stood and apologized to Janet for overstaying my permitted time. Then I nodded to Carl in place of saying goodbye and made my way out. As I walked out of the lounge, I paused to look back at Carl. He sat motionless, facing his reflection in the dark glass, his eyes closed tight as though holding back a deep pain. And I found myself wondering if it was the cancer again, or if this time it was something else. Chapter 21. To calm down, I cranked rock classics from my car's beat-up speakers on the drive home. I sang along with a string of one-hit wonders until I managed to force the dark thoughts out of my head, replacing them with thoughts of the puzzle that Carl had mentioned. Sure, the idea of a puzzle intrigued me, but it was the notion that I had another excuse to spend time with Lila that made me feel better about things. When I got back to the apartment, I dug through the box and found 2 files that held pictures taken of the burning shed. I spent 30 minutes making sure I had the right pictures, then I packed the files under my arm and headed to Lila's apartment. "You like games?" I said to Lila.
"That depends," she said.
"What you got in mind?" Her response caught me off guard, and for a second there I thought that I detected a flirty smile. It nearly made me forget why I came. I smiled back and stumbled over myself. "I got some pictures," I said. She looked a bit confused, then showed me to her dining room table with a nod of her head.
"Most guys bring flowers," she said.
"I'm not most guys," I said. "I'm special."
"No argument there," she said.
I spread out a series of photographs, 7 pictures in all. Of the 7, the first 3 showed the fire raging out of control with no firefighters on the scene yet. Those pictures were poorly framed, haphazard in the use of lighting, and one of them was terribly out of focus. The 2nd set of photos showed the firefighters working the blaze and had been taken by a better photographer. The 1st of these showed the firefighters pulling a hose off the truck, the shed burning in the background. Another showed the water from the fire hose as it first hit the shed. 2 more showed the firefighters spraying water on the fire from 2 different angles. One of these last 2 pictures was the one I'd seen in the newspaper article at the library.
"So what's the game?" she said.
"These pictures here," I said, pointing at the 1st 3 pictures. "They came from the file of a witness named Oscar Reed. He lived across the alley from Carl and the Lockwoods. He saw the flames and called 911. While he waited for the cavalry to arrive, he grabbed an old Instamatic and snapped a few pictures.
Instead of, grabbing a water hose?"
He told the detective that he thought he might be able to sell a picture to the newspaper.
"A real humanitarian," she said.
"In these?" She pointed at the other 4 pictures. These were taken by an actual newspaper photographer, Alden Kane. He heard the fire call over a scanner and ran over there to get some shots.
Okay, she said. So what am I looking for?
Remember in grade school, the teachers used to give out pictures that looked alike but weren't, and you had to spot the differences between them?
That's the game, she said.
That's it, I said, lining the pictures up side by side. What do you see? We studied them carefully. In the early photos, flames shot out of a shed window that faced the alley and the photographer. The roof of the shed was intact, and thick black smoke rolled out of spaces where the 2x4 rafters rested on the walls. In the later photographs, the fire rose in a twisting swirl, like a whirlwind from a hole in the roof. The firefighters arrived, and had just started dousing the flames with water. Kane stood in pretty much the same spot as Reed, because the angles and backgrounds of the pictures were very similar.
I don't see any anomalies, I said, other than the firefighters moving around.
Me neither, Lila said.
Carl said to look at things that should be the same in each picture, so don't look at the fire because that changes as it grows. We looked more carefully at the pictures, examining the background for any slight alteration. Other than an increase in light from the growing flames, Carl's house looked the same in every photo. Then I looked at the Lockwood house in the Reed photos, a standard two-story blue-collar home with a small back porch, a set of three windows on the top floor, and a window on either side of the back door. I looked at the Lockwood house in the Kane photos. Again, it was brighter because of the flames, but otherwise nothing had changed. I went back and forth from one picture to another, wondering if Carl had played a joke on me. Then Lila saw it. She lifted two pictures off the table, one by Kane and one by Reed, and inspected them. There, she said, in that window, to the right of the back door of the Lockwood house. I took the pictures from her and looked at the window, going back and forth between the Reed photo and the Kane photo until I finally saw what she saw. The window to the right of the back door had a set of mini blinds covering it from top to bottom. In the Reed picture, the blinds fell to the bottom of the window. In the later picture, the one taken by Kane, the blinds had been lifted a few inches. I pulled the image closer and saw what looked like the shape of a head and maybe a face peering through the gap.
What the hell? I said. Who is that?
That's a good question, she said. It looks like someone peeking out of the bottom of the window.
Someone was in the house?
I said, watching the fire.
That's what it looks like to me.
Who? I could see Lila reaching back into her memory to conjure up the testimony of the Lockwood family. There's only a handful of possibilities.
More like a shop teacher's handful, I said.
A shop teacher's handful?
Lila asked, looking puzzled. You know, he's missing some fingers, so there are fewer options. I forced a chuckle. Lila rolled her eyes and went back to work.
Crystal's stepfather, Douglas Lockwood, said that he and his son were at his car dealership that evening. He was doing paperwork, and Danny was detailing the car. He said that they didn't get home until after the fire had been put out.
I added what I remembered. Crystal's mom worked a late shift at Dillard's Cafe, I said.
That's right, Lila added, as if showing off her superior grasp of the details.
Her boss, Woody, confirmed it.
Her boss, Woody?
You're making that up.
Look it up,
she smiled. That leaves the boyfriend. What's his name?
Andrew Fisher, she said. He testified that he brought Crystal home after school, drove through the alley, dropped her off, and left.
So where does that leave us? I said.
Lila thought for a minute and then counted on her fingers. I see four possibilities. First, that's not really someone peeking out the window, but I have to believe what I see, so I'm discarding that one.
I see a peek or two, I said.
Second, it's Carl Iverson.
Why would Carl kill her at his house and then watch the fire from the Lockwood house?
I didn't say these were probabilities, just possibilities. It is possible that Carl went to the Lockwood's house after he started the fire. Maybe he knew about the diary and wanted to find it, although it makes no sense for him to start the fire before looking for the diary.
No sense at all, I said.
Third, there's a mystery man, someone who the police never thought about, someone who isn't anywhere in this box of files.
And fourth?
And fourth, someone lied to the police.
Someone like Andrew Fisher?
It's a possibility, Lila said.
with a defiant exhale. I could tell that she wanted to hold firm to her belief that Carl Iverson murdered Crystal Hagen, but I could also see her trying on these new clothes, slipping into the possibility that something had gone terribly wrong 30 years ago. We sat in silence for a while, unsure of what to make of this revelation, neither of us mentioning the tremor we felt pulse through the ground beneath our feet. It was as though we both saw the crack in the dam take shape, but we didn't understand its ramifications. It would not be long before that crack gaped open, releasing its torrent. Chapter 22. By the time I returned to Hillview, I had fully recovered from my confession about my grandfather's death, and I felt rejuvenated by the mystery of the photographs. Carl owed me a confession. At least, that is how I saw it. I beat myself up, telling him my story, and now he had to answer some real questions. He looked healthier than I had ever seen him look. He wore a red flannel shirt in place of the dull blue robe, and his hollow cheeks sported a fresh shave. He smiled a tepid smile, the kind of smile you put on when you run into an ex-girlfriend at a party. I think he knew where we were going to go. It was his turn to open up. My writing assignment had a midterm paper coming due. I had to write about a major turning point in Carl's life, and I needed to have it to the professor in a week. The time had come to unbury his dead, and he knew it. "Hello, Joe." Carl waved me to the chair beside him. "Look at that," he said, pointing out the window. I scanned the random balconies of the apartment across the way, seeing nothing had changed. "What?" I asked.
"Snow," he said. "It's snowing."
I'd seen the snow falling lightly on my drive down, but I'd taken no notice other than to wonder if my car would last through another Minnesota winter. My car's body had gotten so perforated from decay that water from the wet street soaked the carpeting in the trunk after every rain, filling the car with the smell of stale washcloths. Luckily for me, there hadn't been enough snow to accumulate yet.
"You are happy because it's snowing?" I said. "I spent 30 years in prison, much of that time in segregation. I rarely got to watch the snow fall. I love snow."
We followed individual flakes as they floated past the window, rose in a curving breeze, and then fell again, disappearing into the grass. I gave him a few minutes of peace, and allowed him to enjoy the snowfall for the moment. Eventually, it was Carl that started our conversation.
"Virgil stopped by this morning," he said. "He tells me you and he had quite a talk."
"We did."
"And what did Virgil have to say?"
I pulled the small recorder out of my backpack and placed it on the arm of my chair, close enough to pick up Carl's voice. "He says you're an innocent man. He says you didn't kill Crystal Hagen." Carl pondered that statement for a moment and then asked,
"Do you believe him?"
"I read your court file," I said. "I read the trial transcript and Crystal's diary."
"I see," Carl said.
He stopped looking out the window and instead stared at the dingy carpet in front of him.
"Did Virgil tell you why he believed so strongly in my innocence?"
"He told me the story of how you saved his life in Vietnam. He said he ran headlong into a barrage of enemy bullets, knelt down between him and the people trying to kill him. He said he stayed there until the VC were pushed back."
"You gotta love that, Virgil."
Carl chuckled under his breath. "Why?" I asked.
"He'll go to his grave believing that I'm innocent because of what happened that day, even though he's got the story all wrong."
"You didn't save his life?"
"Oh, I suppose I did save his life. But that's not why I charged that position."
"I don't understand." Carl's smile turned a shade more melancholy as he thought about that day in Vietnam.
"I was a Catholic back then," he said. "My upbringing forbade suicide. It was one of those sins that could never be forgiven. The priest said if you killed yourself, you went straight to hell, no questions asked. The Bible also says that there's no greater sacrifice than to give one's life for one's brother. And Virgil was my brother."
"So when you saw Virgil go down that day..."
"I saw it as my chance. I would get in front of Virgil and take the bullet that was meant for him. It was kind of like killing two birds with one stone. I could save Virgil's life and end mine all at the same time."
"It didn't quite work out, did it?" I said, prodding him on.
"That's the messed up part of it all,"
he said.
Instead of getting my head shot off, they gave me medals, a purple heart and a silver star. Everyone thought I was being brave. I just wanted to die. You see, Virgil's belief in me, his loyalty to me, is based on a lie.
So the only person who believes that you are innocent is wrong? I asked, sliding into my intended conversation with an easy subtlety. The snow outside had grown from a light flurry into a snowfall worthy of a snow globe, large wet flakes the size of popcorn kernels swirling in circles. I had asked the question I wanted to ask, and received silence instead of an answer. So I watched the snow, determined not to speak again, giving Carl the time he needed to sort through his thoughts and find my answer.
"You're asking me if I murdered Crystal Hagen," he said finally.
"I'm asking if you murdered her, or killed her, or in any way caused her to no longer be alive. Yes, that's what I'm asking." I could hear a clock somewhere behind me ticking away the seconds as he paused again.
"No,"
he said, his voice barely more than a whisper.
"I didn't."
I dropped my head in disappointment.
"The day I met you, the day you preached all that bullshit about being honest, you told me you were both a killer and a murderer, remember? You said killing people was not the same as murdering them, and you had done both. I thought this was your dying declaration, your chance to come clean. And now you're telling me that you didn't cause her death in any way?"
"I don't expect you to believe me," he said. "Hell, no one's believed me, not even my own lawyer."
"I read the file, Carl. I read the diary. You bought a gun that day. She called you a pervert because you were always watching her."
"I am well aware of the evidence, Joe,"
he said, speaking his words with the patience of a glacier.
"I know what they used against me in court. I've relived the telling of that story every day for the past 30 years, but that doesn't change the fact that I didn't murder her. I have no way to prove that point to you or anyone else. I'm not even going to try to prove it. I'm going to tell you the truth. You can believe it or not. It doesn't matter to me."
"What about the other story from Vietnam?" I asked. Carl shot me a look of faint surprise, then, as if to call my bluff, he said,
"What story would that be?"
"Virgil said it's your story to tell. He said it proves you didn't kill Crystal Hagen." Carl sank back into his wheelchair. He put his fingers to his lips, his hand trembling slightly. There was another story. I could see that now, so I pressed on.
"You said you'd tell me the truth, Carl. It can't be the truth unless it's the whole story. I want to know everything."
Once again, Carl looked past the window, past the snow, and past the apartment balconies.
"I'll tell you about Vietnam," he said. "You can decide what it proves or doesn't prove, but I promise you, it will be the truth."
For the next 2 hours, I didn't speak. I barely breathed. I listened to Carl Iverson go back in his memory. Back to Vietnam. When he had finished, I stood, shook his hand, and thanked him. Then I went home and wrote that part of Carl Iverson's story that marked the turning point of his life. Chapter 23. Joe Talbert, English 317. Biography. Turning Point Assignment. On the 23rd of September, 1967, Private First Class Carl Iverson stepped foot on foreign soil for the first time in his life, stepping off the Lockheed C-141 troop transport in Da Nang, Republic of Vietnam. In a temporary barrack used to house replacement troops, he met another FNG, fucking new guy, by the name of Virgil Gray from Baudette, Minnesota. With Carl hailing from South St. Paul, they were practically neighbors, never mind that the distance between Baudette and South St. Paul was the equivalent of driving through 6 states on the East Coast. As luck would have it, they were assigned to the same platoon and sent to the same firebase, a dusty hilltop with the aesthetics of a baboon's ass on the northwest edge of the Quezon Valley. Carl's squad leader, a short, foul-mouthed E-6 named Gibbs, hid some serious psychological scars behind a mask of cruelty. He seethed with contempt for officers and enlisted men alike, criticizing orders and treating FNGs like plague-carrying rats. He reserved the brunt of his brutality for the Vietnamese, the gooks. They were the source of all things bad in Gibbs's world, and the half-measures taken by the brass toward their eradication picked at Gibbs. When Carl and Virgil arrived at their new home, Gibbs took them aside to explain that President Johnson's war of attrition meant that we had to kill more of them than they could kill of us. It was a strategy that relied upon body counts. The generals winked at the colonels, who gave a nudge to the majors and the captains, who whispered to the lieutenants, who gave a nod to the sergeants, who, in turn, gave standing orders to the grunts.
"If you see a gook running away," Gibbs said, "they're either VC or a VC sympathizer. Either way, don't stand there with your dick in your hand. You shoot the little bastard."
After 4 months in country, Carl had seen enough war to last a lifetime. He'd set up ambushes, watched VC soldiers dissolve into vapor of blood when he clicked the detonator of a Claymore mine, and held the hand of a guy whose name he didn't know as the man cried out his last breath, his legs ripped away from his waist by a bouncing Betty. Carl had grown used to the constant buzz of mosquitoes, but not the random mortars that Charlie liked to throw at them in the middle of the night. He celebrated his first snowless Christmas crawling down the throat of a spider hole. The crack in Carl Iverson's world, one that would cause him to want to die in Vietnam, began on a peaceful winter morning in early February 1968. Light clouds covered the horizon in advance of the sunrise, the stillness of the surrounding valley belying the ugliness of coming events. The brilliance of that sky reminded Carl of a morning he'd spent at his grandfather's cabin in the North Woods, a morning long ago when the notion of killing or being killed held no place in Carl's life. The fighting had weighed Carl down, made him feel old. He leaned back against a pile of sandbags, tossed a cigarette butt into a shell casing the size of a thermos, lit another cigarette, and watched the sunrise.
"Hey, Hoss," Virgil said as he tromped down the dirt path.
"Hey, Virg."
Carl kept his eyes on the horizon, watching the amber slowly sift out of the sky.
"What you looking at?"
"Lake Ada. Come again?"
"I saw that same sunrise coming up over Lake Ada when I was 16.
I was sitting on the back porch of my grandpa's cabin. I swear it was the same red sky."
"You're a long ways from Lake Ada, Hoss."
"Roger that, in every way possible."
Virgil sat down next to Carl.
"Don't let it get to you, man. We're wheels up in 8 months. That's going to be no time. And we're out of here. We'll be Didi Mao."
Carl settled back on his sandbags and took a drag off his cigarette.
"Can't you feel it, Virg? Can't you feel things slipping?"
"Feel what slipping, Hoss?"
"I don't know how to explain it," Carl said. "It's like every time I go into that jungle, I feel like I'm standing on a line I know I shouldn't cross. And there's this screaming in my head like some banshee whirling around me, pulling me, taunting me to step over that line. I know if I cross it, I become Gibbs. I'd say, fuck 'em. They're just gooks, so fuck 'em all."
"Yeah," Virgil said. "I know, I feel it too. The day Levitts bought the farm, I wanted to lay waste to every butterhead in the province."
"Levitts?"
"The guy that got cut in half by that Betty."
"Oh. That was his name?"
"I didn't know."
"But Hoss, once you go there, you don't come back," Virgil said. "That 16-year-old kid on Grandpa's porch watching the sunrise won't be there no more."
"Sometimes I wonder if he's there now."
Virgil turned his face so that Carl could see the seriousness in his eyes.
"We don't have a vote on being here," Virgil said. "And for the most part, we don't have a vote in how we leave. But we do have control of how much of our soul we leave behind in this mess. Don't ever forget that. We do still have some choices."
Carl held out his hand, and Virgil gripped it tightly.
"You got that right, partner," Carl said. "We need to get out of here with our shit intact."
"That's all we need to do," Virgil said.
Another pair of boots kicked down the path from the latrine toward their pile of sandbags.
"Hey, guys,"
hollered Tater Davis. Davis, a true Tennessee volunteer, had joined the company just after Christmas and had attached himself to Virgil like an orphan duck. A little fellow, Tater had peach skin blotted with freckles and ears that stuck out in the side of his face like one of those Mr. Potato Head toys. His parents had named him Ricky, but Virgil called him Potato Head. It stuck throughout the platoon until one day when Ricky held his ground in a bad firefight. After that, he became simply Tater.
Captain say we're fixing to Didi soon, he said.
Don't worry, Tater. They won't leave without you,
Carl said.
Yeah, Virgil added. Cap knows they can't win the war without you.
Tater grinned a goofy, high-cheeked smile.
What did Cap mean when he says we're fixing to go to engine country today?
Tater asked. Carl and Virgil exchanged a knowing glance.
Didn't you study history in school?
Virgil said.
I dropped out of school. 'Twarn't nothing they had to say that I cared to hear.
You ever heard of General Sheridan or Mackenzie?
Carl asked.
Tater gave a blank stare.
What about Custer before he had that unfortunate incident at Little Bighorn?
Virgil added. Nothing registered.
Carl said, Well, let's just say that before the West was won, there was this whole other group of people living there, and we had to get them to leave.
Yeah, but what's that got to do with Vietnam?
Tater said.
Well, the colonel decided that we need to expand our free fire zone,
Virgil said.
The only problem with that is there's this village. We're calling it Oxbow. We gotta move that village, so it's outside the free fire zone. I mean, you can't have a village inside of a free fire zone. The whole point of a free fire zone is to be able to shoot anything that moves.
So we're fixing to move them out?
Tater said.
We're encouraging them to find a better location for their village,
Carl said.
Kind of like we did with the Indians, Virgil added.
Carl took a last drag from his cigarette, dropped it into the 105 casing, and stood up.
We probably ought not keep the big dogs waiting.
The three men hoisted rucksacks onto their backs, slung their M16s over their shoulders, and headed toward the sound of the first helicopter rotors breaking the morning calm. The Hueys made quick work of getting the soldiers to the landing zone, sweeping in fast and low, skidding to a stop at the edge of a field where water buffalo mixed shoulder to shoulder with yellow cows. About 100 yards upstream stood a small hooch with a lean-to for a manger. Another 100 yards beyond that was the collection of huts that made up the hamlet codenamed Oxbow.
You two on me,
Gibbs pointed at Carl and Virgil.
The rest of First Squad take to the road, clear out everything on the way. Assemble the gooks in the center of Oxbow and wait for Lieutenant Mass.
Gibbs led Carl and Virgil toward the hooch in the field, the one with the manger, while the rest of the squad headed down the dirt road that led to Oxbow. As they reached the halfway point between the LZ and the hooch, a patch of elephant grass at the edge of the field shook with life. Carl readied the stock of his weapon against his shoulder and drew down on the moving grass.
Fire, Iverson!
Gibbs called out. Carl squeezed his finger against the trigger, but then eased up. A bulb of black hair bounced through the tall grass, running toward the hooch.
He's evading, Gibbs yelled. God damn it, fire!
Carl squeezed the trigger again, but again released it, as a teenage girl charged out of the elephant grass and scrambled for her home.
It's just a girl, Sarge, Carl said, lowering his weapon. I gave you an order. She's civilian. She's evading, so that means she's VC.
Sarge, she's running home. Gibbs charged at Carl.
Iverson, I gave you a goddamn order. You ever disobey my command again, I'll put a bullet through your head. You hear me?
Tobacco juice dripped from the corners of his mouth as he spat his fury at Carl. The girl, of no more than 15 years, made it to her hooch, and Carl could hear her talking to someone inside that strange, broken Vietnamese tongue he had heard so many times, like a familiar song with indiscernible lyrics. Gibbs turned his attention to the hooch and considered it for a moment.
You two go shoot those cows, Gibbs yelled. Then burn the barn. I'll handle the hooch.
Virgil and Carl looked at each other. There were some pages of the field manual that were worthless in the field, except maybe to wipe your ass with. But there were some instructions that demanded respect. One of those rules to respect was to never clear a hut alone.
Sarge?
Virgil asked.
Now, damn it!
Gibbs barked at Virgil.
I ain't gonna have trouble with you too, am I? I gave you an order. Now go shoot those cows.
Yes, sir.
Carl and Virgil walked to the field, raised their rifles, and started firing into the heads of the unsuspecting beasts. In less than a minute, the cows were dead, and Carl turned his attention toward the hooch. In the distance, he could see the rest of the squad rousting villagers from their huts, marching them down the dirt road, herding them toward the center of the village. Gibbs was nowhere to be seen.
Something ain't right, Carl said. Where's Sarge?
Virgil answered.
That's what I mean. It shouldn't take this long.
The two men moved toward the hooch, their M16s at the ready. Virgil took up a position to cover Carl as Carl crept up to the door, being careful to step on soft grass to avoid the crunch of sand on the hard-packed dirt. He steadied his breathing, listening to muffled grunting coming from the other side of the thatched wall. Carl nodded to himself as he counted down from three and charged through the door.
"Jesus Christ!"
Carl slid as he stopped his charge, pulling the muzzle of his rifle up and almost stumbling backward through the open door.
"Sarge, what the hell?"
Gibbs had the girl pinned down, her knees on the plank floor, her torso pressed down on a rickety bamboo bed, most of her clothing ripped away. Gibbs knelt behind her, his fatigues bunched down around his thighs, his hairy, pale butt cheeks flexing with each thrust.
"I'm interrogating a VC sympathizer," he said over his shoulder.
Gibbs had her arms wrenched behind her back, holding her wrists with one hand, leaning on her, holding her against the bed with his weight. She struggled to breathe as his girth flattened her lungs. In the corner of the hut, an old man lay lifeless on his side, a rut the size of a rifle butt cutting across his nose and left cheekbone, blood trickling from his empty eye socket. With an angry flourish, Gibbs finished his eruption and pulled his pants back up. The girl did not move.
"Your turn,"
he said to Carl. Carl couldn't speak. He couldn't move. Gibbs took a step toward Carl.
"Iverson, I'm telling you to interrogate this VC sympathizer. That's an order."
Carl fought to keep from retching. The girl lifted her head enough to turn and look at Carl, her lips trembling with fear or rage or both.
"Did you hear me?"
Gibbs shouted, pulling his service revolver from its holster and ratcheting around into the chamber.
"I said that's an order."
Carl stared at the girl's face, at the hopelessness in her eyes. He heard Gibbs chamber the round in his 45, but Carl paid it no heed. He would defy the Banshee. He would leave Vietnam with his soul, or die with it intact.
"No, sir," Carl said.
Gibbs' eyes went red. He stabbed the muzzle of the gun into the side of Carl's head.
"You disobeyed a direct order. You're a dead man." "Sarge, what are you doing?"
Virgil yelled from the doorway. Gibbs looked at Virgil, then back at Carl.
"Sarge, this ain't the way to handle it," Virgil said. "Think it through."
Gibbs held the gun against Carl's temple, huffing through his flared nostrils like a horse ridden hard. He stepped back from Carl, the gun still aimed at Carl's head.
"You're right," he said. "There is a better way to handle this."
He holstered his sidearm and pulled a knife from the scabbard strapped to his thigh. He turned to the girl who still lay naked, half on the bed, half on the floor. Grabbing a fistful of her hair, he yanked her to her knees.
"Next time I give you an order to shoot a gook."
He pulled the knife across her throat, cutting deep into the gristle and tissue, the blood spurting onto Carl's boots.
"You better goddamn obey me."
The girl jerked and twitched as blood filled her lungs. Her eyes rolled up into her forehead, and Gibbs let her limp body fall to the floor.
"Now burn this hooch."
Gibbs stepped over the body and put his face into Carl's face.
"That's an order."
Gibbs left the hut, but Carl couldn't move.
"Come on, Hoss."
Virgil pulled Carl backward out of the hooch.
"This ain't our Alamo. We gotta keep our shit intact, remember?"
Carl rubbed his eyes on the sleeves of his shirt. Virgil headed to the manger with his cigarette lighter in his hand. To the north, the entire village had been set aflame. A line of villagers, now refugees, marched like condemned prisoners down the dirt road that would lead them out of the free fire zone. Carl pulled his Zippo from his pocket and touched it to the dried palm fronds and elephant grass of the hut. Within a couple seconds, flame engulfed the thatch roof, the smoke rolling off as thick as water. Carl stepped back from the hut as the ravenous fire licked down from the roof, covering the two bodies on the floor. That's when he saw something that filled his chest with ice. The girl's hand opened. Her fingers reached out, beckoning to Carl. They trembled as the girl strained to reach out. Then they curled back into her palm as the fiery roof crashed down on top of her. Chapter 24. I watched Lila as she read my assignment, her face wincing as she read about Gibbs raping the girl, her eyes looking up at me in disbelief after reading about the girl's hand moving as the burning hut fell in on her. "You can see why Virgil was so adamant that Carl is innocent," I said. "Is this true?" She held up my assignment. "Every word," I said. "Virgil confirmed it. He was there. Said Carl was never the same after that day."
"Wow,"
Lila whispered. "Did you notice that the girl in Vietnam was burned in her hut just like Crystal was burned in that shed?"
"That's what you got out of that?"
I said. "It seems more than coincidental, don't you think? His sergeant put a gun to his head. He was willing to die rather than rape that girl. That's what the story is about. How could that man in Vietnam be the same man who killed Crystal Hagen? If he's really a rapist and a murderer, he would have given in to the dark side when he was in Vietnam."
"You think he's innocent?"
Lila asked, her tone more inquisitive than condemning.
"I don't know," I said. "I'm starting to. I mean, it's possible, isn't it?"
Lila considered my question for a long time before answering, rereading the last part of my assignment, the part where Carl refused Gibbs's order. Then she put the paper down. "Let's just assume for the sake of argument that Carl is not the killer. What does that mean?" I thought about her question for a moment.
"It means that someone else did it."
"Of course it means that," she said. "But who?"
"It could be anyone," I said. "It could be some random guy walking by that saw her home alone."
"I don't think so," she said.
"Why not?"
"The diary," she said.
"I suppose it's possible that some random guy killed her, but if the diary holds any meaning, Crystal was being threatened. Some guy was forcing her to do stuff. That means that Crystal knew her attacker."
"If it's not Carl," I said, "and it's not some random guy, then..."
"If it is not Carl," Lila said, "and that's a big if, then that leaves Doug, the stepfather, Danny, the stepbrother, and Andy, the boyfriend."
She counted the names off on her fingers.
"It could still be someone we don't know, someone that Crystal knew but didn't name in her diary. Unless it's in code."
"We have the file," I said. "We have all the evidence in the case. Maybe we can figure it out." Lila turned on the couch to face me, curling her feet up under her butt.
"This case was investigated by cops, detectives, people who do this for a living. We're not going to figure anything out. It's been 30 years.
"Hypothetically speaking," I said, "if we were going to look into Crystal's murder, where would we begin?"